Hey, and welcome to The Living Stone, a digital ministry of Greystone Baptist Church in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm Annabeth Cross, an associate minister for students and digital discipleship here at Greystone. And today I'm joined by our senior pastor, Chrissy Tatum Williamson. We are delighted to welcome our guest today, Dr. Angela Williams Garrell. Angela has held many roles in her life as an author, professor, researcher, speaker, pastor, chaplain, consultant, and mentor. She has a PhD from Fuller Seminary, is ordained in the Mennonite Church, and most recently taught at Baylor University's Truett Seminary as an assistant professor of practical theology, which is how I first connected with Angela, or Dr. G, as many of her students know her by. Angela began researching joy at the Yale Center for Faith and Culture at Yale University in 2016, which led into her most recent book, The Gravity of Joy, A Story of Being Lost and Found. We're excited to share with you this conversation with Angela about the gravity of joy and her lifelong work toward a life worth living. So hi, Angela. We are so delighted to have this conversation with you today. I know I'm personally so excited to be here and to reconnect with you, as you've played such an integral role in my own ministry and faith journey over the past few years, being fortunate enough to take three of your courses while at Truett Seminary, beginning spring of 2020, so not an ideal time to start classes, but you totally taught me how to do hybrid ministry as we were figuring it out on our own. And you've shaped my ministry with youth and emerging adults and my theology on Jesus and the meaning of life, which have all impacted my role at Greystone now. And so for that, I'm very thankful. And it's just really neat for this to come full circle, to be able to introduce you to my church family and then also to be able to minister with you today and to hear what you have to say more about your work and all the things that you have been researching and living out in your own experiences. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you to both of you for having me for this conversation that we're going to have, which I feel like is going to touch on so many things that are important in the lives of people right now, but especially just throughout their relationship with God. I thank you so much for your ministry and for the ways that you invest in people. And Annabeth, it's just wonderful, especially to see you again after over a year, you know, after graduation, and to be seeing, you know, what you're up to and to be ministering alongside of you. It's a joy.
Thank you. I would love for those who maybe are listening who haven't had the chance to read your book, The Gravity of Joy, yet, for you to give kind of some context to the book and your experiences and kind of share maybe what your definition of joy is and how that all led to you writing The Gravity of Joy.
Yeah, so I was a PhD student in March of 2016 at Fuller Seminary when I was offered a job at Yale, at the Yale Center for Faith and Culture at Yale Divinity School at Yale University. And I was ecstatic. I mean, one, as a PhD student, you're just kind of like hoping, and I know you can relate to this, Annabeth, having just graduated a year ago, you're just like hoping that someone hires you, you know? But then the bonus is when someone hires you and you're totally stoked as you were to work for this, you know, for that community, on that project, on that idea. For me, it was an incredible opportunity. It really like a once in a lifetime sort of thing. You know, I get to study joy at the Yale Center for Faith and Culture. That's what I was hired to do. We're going to spend the next 3 years reading about, talking about, writing about joy. And I wondered, you know, for the first few months, like whether there was any other better job in the world for me. And then 8 months into the project, if you've read The Gravity of Joy, you know that I got a phone call on a Sunday afternoon that shifted everything. And I was told that my one of my family members, Dustin, died at 30 by suicide. And that was the beginning of 4 weeks that were absolutely devastating. The next week of ministry, because I was really called upon by my family to be a minister during this difficult time, while also grieving the loss of Dustin myself, but helping to plan his funeral, speaking at his funeral, all these sorts of things. And then I got back to Yale, to Connecticut, where I lived, And I remember thinking, like, I don't know how our family's going to recover from this. I don't know what even healing could look like. And then in the next couple of weeks, 2 weeks later, I got a call from my younger sister that my nephew had died suddenly at 22. He had died of cardiac arrest, sudden cardiac arrest due to previously unknown heart condition. And then found myself flying to Albuquerque, New Mexico to be with my oldest sister and all my other sisters to support her and to grieve the loss of our nephew. Spoke at his funeral that Saturday. And then a couple of days later, got back to Connecticut. A couple days later, got a message that my dad was in the ER fighting for his life, and found myself on planes once again 2 days later, three planes, and in a rental car to get to my dad in Appalachia, to the hospital that he was at. And I spent the last 5 hours of my dad's life with him. My dad died after about 12 years of opioid use. And anyone in this region of the country knows how devastating the opioid crisis has been in the Appalachian region. And my dad was one of many people who has died because of that. So I lost three family members in 4 weeks, spoke at all of their funerals, and found myself in the midst of just profound, profound grief while trying to study and write about joy. And for a year and a half, and it's really, really important that people know that, for a year and a half, I walked in that fog of grief. I recount this journey in the first half of my book. I joke a lot that my book is like a psalm, and if you quit halfway through, you're going to be pretty depressed. You know, as many of the psalms do, like, they're just very honest about their laments, about their anger, about their fear, about their frustration, about their sadness and their tears. And where is God? What are you doing? And that's the first half of my book. And so for a year and a half, when I talk about it in the book, that's what I'm talking about, is that year and a half of the fog of grief. I also had 6 months of EMDR therapy, which I really want to say that I feel like that mental health professionals and people in helping professions like pastors can work together, and I think should work together, because I think healing can happen at the intersection of multiple people across helping professions connecting. And so my EMDR therapist really helped me to be able to talk about those 4 weeks in a way like I am right now without breaking down, and helped to heal some of the trauma of those 4 weeks. And so my book recounts the first half, that year and a half, and what it was like to experience the grief that followed those 4 heartbreaking weeks. But then it takes a turn in the center of the book when I meet a group of women at a Bible study at a maximum security prison. I got an invitation at church one night. I mean, all of us did. But from the front, they were announcing that the Bible study team at this women's prison needed help. And this was a pretty big ask, because it was quite a journey to get there. It always took over an hour to get to the prison each week, and then over an hour to get back. And I felt like I was at the end of myself. I was really, really struggling to pray, to want to be at church. I didn't feel like I had anything to offer anyone else, but I felt that stirring in my spirit, which was like, you need to go and do this. Like, it was like a thing that, it was like a God moment where God was like, you need to go do this. Like, I have something for you. And it was in meeting these women that I began to become more passionate about our work. And I began to realize that joy was not shallow. It was not trivial. It was vital. Not only for surviving, but like for thriving. And as Alexander Schmemann, the priest, has said, I began to realize that joy is the tonality of Christian faith. It's how it sounds. And so I felt challenged at that time to begin writing about joy from the perspective of my family suffering and these women suffering. And I wondered, like, how does joy happen in the midst of suffering? Why is it possible? What is joy? How do we cultivate it? I later learned that we can't really cultivate it. I mean, it's a virtue. We can work toward it, but in the sense, only in the sense that we can become more open to it. And so that comes to the definition. So my book is about what I learned about joy amid suffering from these women in prison, from my reflecting on those 4 weeks through the lens of Christian faith, rethinking where God is in the midst of suffering, and really diving deeper into what joy is. There's lots of definitions of joy throughout the book. One of my favorites, I'll give you three. One of my favorites is that joy is the recognition of, this is probably the most technical definition, joy is the recognition of and connection we feel to meaning, truth, beauty, goodness, and one another. Second, joy is an illumination, the ability to see beyond to the something more. And third, joy is the very being and presence of God ministering to us.
That's so profound. And I love that that's where you stopped just now. I'm looking at the handout from our group conversation around joy, and the whole last page of the handout is me trying to identify those definitions kind of throughout your book and list them for the group of people at Greystone who read the book and came to 3 gatherings to discuss it. I wanted to provide a little bit of context in case folks are watching or listening here and either haven't read the book or were not part of our conversation as a church-wide book study, just to kind of share where the congregation has been on this journey with you. We offered the book, your book, The Gravity of Joy, to anybody who wanted to join. We had between, I don't know, maybe like 15 people on average for 3 weeks in a row on Sunday nights in October. And for us, we started out as just an intro. I wanted people to come without feeling like they had to read, 75 pages before they ever come to the group. So I said, no homework for this first session. Let's just get together and kind of talk. And we offered our own definitions of joy before reading anything. And I have lists of joy is and joy is not that that we made as a group. We shared stories of people who had been our teachers about joy, often parents or grandparents or friends who played a special role in our lives. And we talked about, from a spiritual perspective or a human perspective, I guess, also joy as 3 different things. First, joy as an emotion. And I brought the feelings wheel that, is fresh out of every therapist's office, super helpful for us to look at and kind of locate joy there as something that we feel. Joy as a spiritual gift, the fruits of the Spirit are love, joy, peace, etc. So it's something that God gives to us. And then joy as a spiritual practice or spiritual discipline, something that we work towards but can never perfectly and fully realize or actualize in our own life. And so those are kind of the 3 buckets we started with. And of course, at the last session, we had blown those all apart and they were informing one another and not so easily defined. But one thing that we didn't plan on, I thought we might talk about grief because the pandemic was a traumatic experience for everyone and a prolonged traumatic experience, different traumas, different kinds of grief from different people, just depending on, who you were trapped at home with for 18 months, and so I felt like that might be where our conversation around grief and finding joy in the midst of suffering, I thought we might kind of linger in that area. However, in Raleigh, a few days before our second gathering, there was a shooting. 5 people were killed, not far from the church, not in our neighborhood, but definitely in the neighborhood where several of our church members live. And as the story began to piece itself together, I think many of us in this church community felt really close, to this, tragic event in a way that we didn't feel the proximity. We might mourn with the families in Uvalde, but it's not right down the street, right? It's a different kind of grief. And so that week, kind of preparing for Sunday morning worship and then preparing for our conversation with the book group dealing with the first half of your book, lament kind of became the theme. And all of a sudden, the words and the stories that you were telling and the ways that you were really struggling to find joy felt deeply personal for all of us in the room. So that was our second session. Our third session, we brought pictures of the people who had taught us about joy and shared stories. We spent probably 45 minutes just sharing stories and kind of meandered to what we think is where you're leading us, which is that joy is discovered and felt often in the sharing of stories, in the sharing of the lived experience of grief and the memories. But there's an undeniably communal aspect to it. That's been the journey at Greystone with the book. So just to provide that for you and for anybody else who might be listening, that is where we have been. And you're exactly right about the Psalms. If we were going to stop at the end of chapter 4 or chapter, I think it's 4, right? 5 is helpful help. I think that's right. We would have been very depressed. So. But we didn't stop. We finished.
Yeah, but anyone who's listening, I think if you haven't read The Gravity of Joy, and it's on Audible, by the way, too, and it's read by me. And so if you prefer Audible books, you want to take me on hikes or walks with you, you know, feel free to do that as well, or on a drive. But I think anyone who's experienced grief will feel very seen and very resonated with in chapters 1 through 4. Like, you'll feel like, okay, Angela was honest about this. She did not, you know, she didn't minimize grief. She really humanized the grief experience. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's my hope, but that's what I hear most from people, is like, yeah, man, you really described that accurately. That is how it feels.
You did, and one more thing before we move to the actual questions that we prepared for today. But I was really taken by there's another page or two or three pages in a row where you talk about grief is, and you describe it in a number of different ways, and I don't have my handout in front of me, but I felt like some of the images that you provided around what grief feels like there's one where you're like, it's like a robber standing behind the door, like waiting to, you know, here it is. On its cruelest days, grief feels like an assailant who waits around the corner in order to cover your mouth from behind. It surprises you unexpectedly, takes your breath, terrorizes you, and reminds you that life will never be the same. That is arresting. And so accurate.
Mm. Yeah, you know, because after you've had a traumatic event in your life, whether that is divorce or the loss of someone that you love, a pet, you know, the loss of a dream, you've just been diagnosed with a chronic illness or a terminal, you know, illness. It like, you can be going about your day. You're trying to do your life. You're trying to put your life back together again. And then out of nowhere, you're just triggered and reminded life won't be the same. Like, my life has forever changed. And yes, that's where it kind of takes your breath away, is like, no matter how normal I try to imagine that my life is, no matter how much I'm trying to go back to work or, you know, create a new routine or engage with friends or, you know, keep going, I'm reminded out of nowhere that, like, no, life is different and you have to face this. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. You talk a lot, and one of your other definitions of joy, that is in the book, and then also what we shared about in our class, is joy being the work of resistance against despair, being the counter agent to despair. So to kind of shift to that second half of The Gravity of Joy, and you've shared this all throughout your book of your own personal experience and then on a national scale, like, it is so hard today to find, well, many people feel like it's hard today to find joy because of all the epidemics we're facing in addiction and in crises of suicide and despair and the list goes on and on and on. And that you're also, part of your work has been trying to define and find a life worth living. And that is a course that I went through and you challenged me through to, you know, write a final paper on it. And I don't think I still have an answer, but we struggled together and were challenged together to find what that might mean. So I was wondering if you could kind of explain your framework about your work and definition of the good life, a meaningful life, and how joy comes into play with that and how the two have kind of balanced each other. But as we're struggling with this grief, what is a life worth living? Where does joy come into play? How do we find that?
Yeah. So obviously, as Annabeth just said, this was like 14 weeks. So I'll try in a few minutes to respond to that question, but I'd rather have 14 weeks to talk together about it. But essentially, that course, Jesus and the Meaning of Life, is one version of it. Another I taught at Yale is Life Worth Living. But I like to use the phrases interchangeably, a meaningful life, a good life, a true life, the life worth living, because all of them have challenges and benefits. And so for me, it's helpful to kind of use the phrases interchangeably. But I think that for all of us to be able to live with joy is to have a vision of the life worth living that is sustainable, especially in the midst of suffering, which means there are a number of questions that together as Christian communities that we need to continually ask and answer. And one of those questions is, how should we respond to suffering? Another way of asking that is, what is the role of suffering in a meaningful life, in the life worth living? Can I be suffering and life still be good? There are a number of other questions that we asked in that class that I think are also important for Christian communities to navigate together. And these are how does a good life feel? Can I be sad, frustrated, full of fear, and life still be good? Do feelings matter? Another is, how should I respond to failure? My own mistakes. How do I respond to moral failure? How do I respond when a Christian community, a leader I trust, someone I love fails me? How do I respond to when life fails me, you know, which is connected to suffering, but also can be differentiated from it in important ways as well. And then what does it mean for me to lead my life well? What are the virtues and habits and values of a meaningful life? What does it mean for life to go well? What should we hope for? And then for us in this class, Jesus and the Meaning of Life, it was important for us to ask these questions, thinking about what it means for life to go well, to feel well, to be led well. How should we respond to suffering? How should we respond to failure in light of the life and teachings of Jesus? And I think what this kind of conversation does, when we're able to ask these kinds of big questions together and to begin to have answers because of the life and teachings of Jesus, because of Christian tradition, because of community, then it helps us to feel more connected to the truth, to meaning, and like to the meaning that's in our lives, to what good is, to one another as well, which, as I started in the first, you know, my first definition of joy was, it's the recognition of and the connection we feel to meaning, truth, beauty, goodness, and one another. So I think the life worth living journey goes hand in hand with joy, because it's a journey of really trying to cultivate and discern and to name what's meaningful about our lives. What is the truth about one another? What is, you know, and to affirm what is good and true in one another. Joy is a celebration of the truth. And then also to name what is goodness and what is good about one another, to remind each other that Genesis 1, like the message of Genesis 1 is, you were made good. You know, that is Genesis 1 in one sentence. The world is good. You were made good. and then in this conversation, too, we begin to feel more deeply connected to others because we realize, oh, many other people have similar struggles as me. Many people wonder about the same things that I do. And so that's a little bit about the connection between the life worth living and joy. And I think that as we participate in answering big questions like this, that in itself becomes this work of resistance against despair, because despair wants to tell us there is no meaning. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, life is meaningless. Life is pointless. So your suffering has no goodness. You know, you are suffering, so your life can't be good. Mm-hmm. You know, despair wants to tell you there is no truth to be found. Despair wants to say there is, you have failed, the world has failed you, there's no goodness in you, there's no goodness in the world. Despair wants to tell you, you can see other people, but they can't see you. You are disconnected, right? And so, but this work of cultivating a vision that can sustain us, asking these big questions together, struggling and wrestling with the answers together, helps us to feel more deeply connected to all these things, which helps us, I think, to be more open to the joy of God.
That's beautiful. I especially love the persistence of the language of truth in your work. You know, living in a world in which truth feels negotiable at best, elusive, you know, questionable, to remember that there is a point and a place for truth to be told. And not in a combative, like arguing way. It's not a war on facts, but like in a celebratory way. Like this is the truth. This is reality. This is what it means to be human. And this, and the nature of suffering is kind of part of that human experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that before reading your work, I would have included the celebration of truth as a component of finding joy. And so I thought that was interesting the way that you wove it in, and you just did it now in your response to the first question. I think in some of what you said just now, you're talking about God and where God is as joy becomes realized and as joy kind of bubbles up from human experience. One of the participants in our book group asked a question that she wanted me to bring here today, and I think it's a really good one. And so I'm just going to ask it. She says, in your relation to your experiences of grief, which also at times feel like a crisis of faith in addition to a personal experience of grief. And you can tell us if that's an accurate characterization or not. But we want to know kind of why does God allow suffering? And that's the follow-up question. We want to know first, before that, how has your view of God changed? How has your understanding of where God is in the midst of suffering evolved through this journey for you?
I actually do think that it's helpful to start with the second question.
Okay.
Because it has me need to say what I mean about like how my journey with God has shifted. Wow. I would say that I did have a bit of a crisis of faith. But the other way to look at it is that it was a renewal of faith. Mm-hmm. And I think that you can look at the same, I mean, I'll be 40 in a few weeks. And so I think that a lot of people talk about like a midlife crisis. I mean, we can think about it as crisis or we can think about it as renewal or restoration, because a crisis becomes like a breaking open. So in that breaking open, you know, I think that that's where God can do something new. And that's what we see, right, over and over and over again throughout scripture, is that in the breaking open, God does something new. In the death of one thing, like something new is resurrected, is restored, is reimagined. So the second question is, why do we suffer, right? Is that the...
Yeah, and where is God in it?
Yeah, where is God? Yeah, and where is God in suffering? Both, right? That's
right.
Okay.
Both.
Yeah. If there's anything that this journey has taught me, is that I deeply, deeply resonate with James Cone, who wrote a book called God of the Oppressed. And James Cone says in his book, God of the Oppressed, that the Bible is not so much about why human beings suffer, but about what Christ has done, about what God through Christ has done about human suffering. So mm-hmm. for me, I think that the more that, like, after this, those 4 weeks of hell, which I call them in the book, for me, it wasn't like asking, why do we suffer? Is it human, you know, will? Is it this or that? You know, it just became a futile practice. Like, it was like, what is like sitting around wondering why we suffer did not find it to be helpful to me. And in fact, the more I looked at the Bible, the more it seemed to me that it was that suffering is inevitable. Mm-hmm. It's not that, you know, suffering won't happen, but it's about how will we stay connected with God in light of suffering. And what has God, more importantly, what has God done in light of human suffering? And so that's been the focus of my faith and of my life in the last few years is, okay, God, where are you in the midst of suffering? Which just comes to your first question, right? And so for me, I've really held on to sort of this Trinitarian understanding of where God is in suffering, which is God the Father, God the Mother, like God, who is, you know, encompasses everything, all things, who is much more than we could ask or imagine, right? God is with us in suffering, and God is a witness to our suffering. Like, I look at scripture, and that's what I see again and again and again and again in people's lives, is that God is and is with us. Like, God is near to those who are suffering. And then God is a witness. God is willing to say, I recognize what is happening in your life, and I lament this that is happening to your community, to your individual life. And then we see this in the life of Jesus, right? Jesus was a healer and a helper of the wounded, as Henry Nouwen has said. And so what we see is in his ministry that he was the person who said to the woman who was walking next to her dead son in the funeral procession in Luke 7, he says, I see your pain. I am a witness. In John 11, we see it with Mary when she's weeping because Lazarus has died, her brother, right? He says, Mary, I see your pain. I am a witness. You know, woman at the well, whom I like to call Sarah, you know, Sarah, I see your pain. I am a witness. Like, what we see in Jesus's life is this carrying through of what the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures show us, which is that God is a witness to our pain and God enters into human suffering. We see that in the life of Jesus. And then we see that Jesus in John 14 says, I've given you the Holy Spirit as a comforter, as an encourager to you. And I love this, right? That the Spirit then becomes our constant companion in all things that happen in our life, including and especially in suffering, right? And that I love in Romans 8 when the Apostle Paul says that when we can't pray, that the Spirit prays on our behalf. Mm-hmm. That's what I have learned about, you know, those are answers I can live with. And for each one of us, I think we have to, in that question of how should we respond to suffering? What is the role of suffering in a good life? We all have to be able to have answers to those questions that allow us to sleep at night.
When you were talking about withness and witness, which is also in your book, that's a word play that really took root with our book group. And I love when you were talking just now, a new thought kind of hit me that I hadn't yet attached to this whole process of grief and joy. But when we think about Christian advocacy and social engagement, one of the things that Jesus does throughout the Gospels is, to your point, goes near people who are suffering and is with them, so is proximate and close to them physically in his human body and bears witness. That's truth-telling to their suffering. And in many ways, that is the call of advocacy, is to go and to be near groups of people and individuals who are experiencing systemic suffering and to tell the truth about what they are experiencing and to help, or maybe just to be quiet long enough to let them tell the truth and let others hear it. And so I love that. I had not yet connected that with this journey, which sometimes feels so personal when we're thinking about what are the things that are grieving, I'm grieving right now, and how can I work through that, and where is God in that? But there's also a macro narrative of grief that's happening. Anyway, just a thought.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And I think this is an important, you know, there's a moment here to be able to say that, like, joy doesn't need sorrow to be joy. You know, joy is not dependent on sorrow, but joy can accompany sorrow. And that's because, like, I think that it's in sorrow that we are most attuned to the need for meaning, for truth, for beauty, for goodness, for connection with others and with God. And so when it's realized, we, like, that's when we kind of sometimes can feel joy, like, most acutely, is because when it comes, then it's like, oh man, I've been really, really aching for this, you know? And that's why joy, Luke 15 is my favorite ode to joy in all of scripture. And if you think about it, this ode to joy from beginning to end is all about what is lost being found, right? Mm-hmm. It's the 99 sheep, and the shepherd leaves them to go find the one and rejoices when the sheep is found. And then the woman who loses her coin, right, goes and finds the coin. And when she finds it, she rejoices. And then the father loses his son, doesn't know where he is. And when he comes back home, he rejoices. You know, this ode to joy is about what is lost being found, being recovered, mm-hmm. being restored, being resurrected. I think that's why joy is such a profound, beautiful emotion, far more profound than happiness, has so much more depth, because it is about this deep longing for the goodness of God, for the goodness of the world, for the truth, for meaning. Yeah.
Yeah, and your idea of witness and witness, I mean, I feel like taking your classes, that's been ingrained in me and into my ministry with youth specifically. But I wonder if that's, to go into our next question about spiritual practices for both individual and communal spaces that help us create space to cultivate joy. I wonder if we start with, is witness and witness where we start? Is that how we cultivate joy together and with ourselves individually with God? What are some gateways to joy, as you call them? Obviously, you said we can't put joy on our to-do list, which is something I would love to do because I have many to-do lists. But you talk about putting ladders up against fences and providing ways for joy to creep in. So how do we create space to cultivate joy? Is it witness and witness along with other things? What are some individual and communal practices we can take?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. It starts with witness and witness. Absolutely. Especially in this day and this time, I think, and witness is really an openness to empathy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a desire to understand the laments of people around us. And then as we begin to understand what those things are, it becomes very difficult to not then have empathy for people. Right. And then as we have empathy for other people, then we can develop respect for them. And as we begin to respect them, and then we begin to listen to them more with our whole selves. And that's, you know, and as we listen with our whole selves, we learn to love. And so, I think that it does begin with empathy, and empathy is absolutely a gateway to joy, because when I feel like you have been a witness to me, you have been with me, and you've empathized with what I'm going through, I feel more connected to you. And that brings me joy. You know, even if it is a sobering joy, a healing joy, a quiet joy. And that's another reason why it's such a beautiful emotion, right? Is that it can be modified in so many ways. It doesn't always have to be an exuberant joy, which I think is a lot of times like how we think about it, you know? Another gateway to joy is hope. Jürgen Moltmann, the great German theologian, says that hope is the anticipation of joy. Hope is on its way to joy. That's why I think that joy is the ultimate counteragent to despair, is because joy is hope realized. And so hope is about believing that there's a pathway, that there's a way where there seems to be no way. And that's what the church historically, I think, has done so beautifully for people, is that we help people to remember that there has been suffering. The community of God has suffered from the Israelites to today, right? We have been a suffering people, and yet God has continued to make a way when there seemed to be no way, right? And so we are a people of hope. One of the things that I do on church retreats, on joy retreats, is we always start with hope. And so I encourage everyone who's listening, maybe you do it as a church community, to surround yourself as much as possible with hope, with visions of hope. I have a vision board on a poster board in my living room right now, filled it out on Sunday with my hopes for the next couple of years, as a joy practice, as a way of being more open to joy in my own life, right? I have quotes on little notes all over my place, all over my house, that say things like on my bathroom mirror, beautiful things will happen. Be open to beautiful things. Joy is coming, you know? And so hope is it's about like saying, okay, I am open to the idea that you will make a way, that a pathway forward will be found. I'm not saying, like, you know, I'm just open to the idea of it. Like, that's where you can start, right? Gratitude is another gateway to joy. And I would say that joy, the spiritual practice of joy that you can do, you can't make yourself feel the emotion of joy, and you can't give yourself the spiritual gift of joy. Like, that's something that God does. You know, I think the characteristic of joyfulness is given to particular people as a spiritual gift, but you can choose to rejoice. Mm-hmm. And so gratitude and rejoicing are really, really integrated with one another. And so you can look for good things in your life and be grateful to God for them and rejoice over them. And it can be very, very simple things, such as today I am breathing, which means I am alive, which means it's not the end. And for that, I am grateful. Like, I am breathing, I am alive, it's not the end. I can be grateful that the sun is shining into my window on this particular day, and it's making a path through the floor and I can see it. And, you know, I can be grateful for the coffee that I'm holding in my hand because it's warm and it makes me happy. And, you know, I can, you know, so I rejoice over this, that I rejoice that I can turn on lights in my home and I can, you know, turn a tap and water comes out. Sometimes it starts with just really simple gratitude, and marveling at the world around us that we often take for granted, you know, and rejoicing like, God, I have these resources, you know? And so gratitude, hope, and rejoicing over the things that we're thankful for, empathy. And then finally, I'll end with a celebration of the truth is a really helpful gateway to joy. We live in a world, and I love Christine Pohl. She's a Christian ethicist. She wrote in a book, Living into Community, that truth-telling, the practice of truth-telling, is affirming what is good and true. And so in the prison, and you read about it in my book, what I began to do was one night we put up a bunch of flip chart paper around, and I split them into small groups, and I asked the women, what do you have that you're grateful for? And what we realized is that in some way or another, every group had named that we had our words. Mm-hmm. That prison could take away many things, but it couldn't take away our words. And so we realized that speaking words of truth, affirming what is good and true about one another, could be a superpower. And so we used it as often as we could, you know, and we started putting a chair in the center of the circle on Wednesday nights, and I would write different liturgies, and we'd have a person sit in the chair. We'd, like, you know, we'd start with one person, and we would say, Chrissy, like, you know, you are beautiful. You are smart. Your life matters to God, and it matters to us. God has a purpose for your life. And then Chrissy would stand up, and then Annabeth would sit down, and she would, you know, and every person would take a turn sitting in the chair and having the words of truth spoken over them, like, God made you good, you know, and everyone would have an opportunity to read the words over someone else. And what I realized with this practice over time, this habit that we developed over time, began to do a work in us. It became a work of resistance, of, I'm going to resist the voices that say I'm alone, that I don't matter, that I can never forgive myself, that I can't recover, that I'll always feel the way that I do, that God, that, like, that I am a bad person, that I, you know, can never find who I am again. You know, all these sorts of voices, you know. So we need Christian communities who cultivate this habit of speaking the truth to one another. And so I encourage your Christian community, you know, to do that. And we did it in our classes, and Annabeth saw firsthand what it was like. And so I started doing it at the end of Jesus and the Meaning of Life, at the end of Life Worth Living. We'd put a seat in the middle of the circle, and everyone would have a turn sitting in the seat and having words read over them, and then reading words over someone else. And it's powerful in a world where so many of us tell lies to ourselves, where so much of the world is about critiquing ourselves, being jealous, you know, hating ourselves, like self-harm and destruction. And then also just like failing and not ever feeling like we can recover. or losing ourselves along the way, man, this celebration of truth really is a bringer of joy. Sorry, I get really excited about that practice.
No, I remember that being such a meaningful thing for me and my classmates who were in that class. And that visual of you doing that in the prison has always stuck with me. And the last words you leave us with in the book before the epilogue in the last chapter of, like, don't be afraid to tell someone that their life is worth living and just do it as much as possible. Like, that, those words can be life-changing for anybody. And, I mean, I think if you don't know what a physical practice might be to cultivate joy, maybe just sharing those sharing words with somebody in a verbal practice is what all it will take to find that for them. So thank you for sharing that. I know that's been impactful for me, and I hope that I can do that for my youth in our church, and that could be something that we can live into as well.
Yeah, it's so simple, right? And yet such, it can change the course of someone's life for them to realize your life matters to me. Like, your life is worth living to me. You matter to me. You are important to me. I see you. Man, like, so many beautiful things start with those simple words.
I've taken copious notes from our conversation today, even though this is all recorded and I can revisit it anytime. And I think I have 3 different versions of the book: audio, Kindle, and hard copy. But there is a profound truth in all of this that I think I needed to hear again today, and I hope that others who tune in after the fact, I mean, I can't imagine living a day and not needing to be reminded that your life matters to other human beings, but also to God. And what a powerful vision for what the church could be at its best. You know, if the church could be a place where all people could come and hear that profound truth every day: you matter to God and you matter to me, and let's go live like that.
Right. And that's what we see in the life of Jesus, right? Is that, yeah, that's where it was all, it was just like people always left Jesus's presence and they seemed to think that anything was possible, that they were made good, and that they could start again.
Even on the Sabbath. Yes. I mean, it's crazy. Well, I think we want to ask you, kind of as we're wrapping up our time, is there, like, we've got a ton of wisdom from you already, but is there any, like, final word or anything that you want to leave us with today as kind of the last nugget of truth in this conversation?
Yeah, I'm really praying that God will give both of you and all of the people who listen to this conversation the courage, as William Blake Coffin once prayed, the courage to risk something big for something good. I pray that God gives you the courage to participate in God's joy as a work of resistance of despair. I pray that God gives you the courage to enter in to the suffering of those around you. I pray that God gives you the courage to see what is truthful in the world and to affirm it and to rejoice over it, even and especially in a world that is so weighed down by everything but.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Angela, for being in this conversation with us and sharing your wisdom through your book and through this and just through the life that you live and you lead every day through the students that you've impacted and all the people who have been impacted and shaped by your work and your life. I know I'm grateful, and I know others are as well. And so thank you for joining us. And our Greystone community here in Raleigh. Very thankful for Zoom and all the ways that we can connect digitally and do hybrid ministry together. So that's really great. Something you taught me well. So I thank you so much for being here and are just so appreciative of who you are and the work that you're doing and will continue to do in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Grell. It's great to meet you. Thanks for being with us.
Yes, enjoy Tex-Mex. We miss it a lot. And
absolutely. I will enjoy some Tex-Mex just for you.
Okay. Chrissy's husband's also from Texas, so we bond over missing that a lot. So and HEB, oh.
Whatever, oh my gosh, what a glorious story. I know. I'm giving you a hug right now, too. Yes. Please tell your mom I said hello, too.
I will.
She's so great. I love your mom. Yeah, her energy is like, it's contagious. Yeah.
She is a great mom to have. So I miss her as well. So, but I will tell her that you said hello.
Yeah, please do. Okay. So nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Have a good one.
Yeah. Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye.